Oftentimes, it's better to start with creativity to help you learn the facts.
Life is too short to learn a list of 1,000 rando words.
From the campus of Stanford University, this is Schools In with your hosts, Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope.
Welcome to Schools In. I'm Denise Pope, senior lecturer with the Graduate School of Education here at Stanford, and I am with my co-host, Dan Schwartz, dean of the Graduate School of Education.
Denise, home alone Pope.
I'm not exactly home alone. We are sheltering in place here in California. So I am seeing Dan through a screen because we are doing our part to stop the coronavirus.
And so how are you doing with all your kids at school, sort of online?
Everybody is home. Yes, everyone is home. We are readjusting to, we were empty nesters. We are no longer empty nesters. So it has been a readjustment. How about you, Dan?
It's about my usual life. I stay at home most of the time, answering email. I'm on a lot of meetings. This is sort of the job of a dean, is to be in meetings all day. So being in meetings online all day, you really recognize you're in meetings all day.
Yeah.
But otherwise, I have lots of frozen pizza, so I'm feeling okay.
That's good.
So one thing, these are extraordinary times, and it's good to try and wrap your head around them and sort of big sweep issues, as well as some of the small moment to moment stuff. So what I would like to do is to quiz you.
Oh my gosh. During the coronavirus, you are giving me a quiz.
Some things can't change. So this has made me think of Maslow's hierarchy of needs. I don't know if people remember this. This is a pyramid, and at the bottom is physiological needs, and at the top is self-actualization. So Denise, can you name the other three? So physiological needs, air, water, food, shelter, sleep, clothing, reproduction. Next on the list.
If my memory serves me, I think it's safety. You have to feel safe, right?
Very good. Personal security, employment, resources, health, property. Next.
I am going to say belonging, like social, something with social, belonging, family.
Very good. Very good. Love and belonging, friendship, intimacy, family, sense of connection. So it's important to understand all of these outcomes are equally important. His argument is if you don't have something lower, you can't get something higher. But he's not saying, one's more important.
Okay. So wait, let's just be clear. So I thought that the shelter and food, that's super important. That's why they're on the bottom.
Well, but so is love. A life without love is a life without nourishment.
Damn, that's beautiful.
Thank you. No, the idea is if you don't have air, safety needs, you're not going to worry about safety needs.
Right.
So above love and belonging.
Oh boy. I don't know. So there's something between love and belonging and self-actualization.
That is correct.
I don't know.
Esteem.
Esteem, like esteem. Feeling good about yourself?
Respect, self-esteem, status, recognition, strength, freedom is esteem.
That's interesting. Freedom. I would put freedom a little bit lower.
Send him a blog. Blog.
Yeah. Okay.
I think Maslow will.
Oh, he'll respond for sure. Yeah.
So the striking thing to me about this hierarchy is that, with the coronavirus, people's first response is the physiological needs. Right, that we've got to provide food, so forth. And then you start worrying about the other things. The thing that's striking to me is people are finally beginning to realize that schools are sort of responsible for all of these, mm-hmm. right? That the school is the great safety net of society. And so, without schools, schools are providing food. They're providing safety for a lot of kids. Social connection has become a big issue. It's schools aren't just about self-actualization. They provide all these things. And at the same time, we already have situations where schools are not exactly equal in their abilities to deliver these things, right? So we worry a great deal about the quality of schooling and the inequities of it. And this crisis really brings it out. It really brings out sort of how important school is for providing all of these supports and needs, and how variable the schools are. Where, you know, it's not a bad prediction to say schools that have been sort of low on the totem pole for being able to provide equity are really going to hurt now in this situation. And so this is our a good substance of our conversation. We really wanted to talk to Jonathan Rosa, who is a professor of education at Stanford. He's a sociocultural anthropologist. That's a lot of syllables. It means he studies how language and race intersect in school and learning experiences. He also teaches a popular and important class called Equity in Schooling in our teacher education program. So welcome, Jonathan, for joining us.
Thank you. It's good to be here, even under complicated circumstances, let's say.
Right. Here being the internet.
Yeah, yes. Jonathan is sheltering in place as well, and we thank you for Zooming in with us today. So, Jonathan, given that you study this, what are your thoughts right now during this time, particularly your thoughts on that equity issue that Dan brought up?
It's actually interesting to think about it in relation to the equity course that I teach often with our close colleague, Ontario Garcia, and then we inherited this course from another anthropologist at Stanford, Ray McDermott, all of whom have been thinking about these issues surrounding the ways that schools aren't just spaces where healing happens and where learning happens and where support happens, but they've also in many situations been places where hurt happens and trauma happens and inequalities are exacerbated or worsened or even created in some circumstances. And so it's this really complex situation where we want to embrace the hope that we often invest in and associate with mainstream schools, while also recognizing that that hope hasn't been realized in so many situations. And so when I think about a moment that feels like crisis right now, part of what's so striking to me is the way that for many communities, crisis has never not been the case, and crisis is in fact the norm. And so what for some people is felt as the shocking encounter with instability is for so many just what everyday life looks like on the day-to-day. And what that suggests to me as we approach this is that we can't simply respond with a spirit of recuperation or with a spirit of return to status quo or to a norm. In fact, this has to be an opportunity and for potential reckoning with what was never stable, what was never fair or equitable or sustainable or healthy. And so that's, I think, part of what I'm thinking about right now. And, you know, what are the communities that have always been trying to figure out what you do in unstable circumstances, what possibilities exist when there are no assurances around access to resources? And so these are some of the things that I'm grappling with right now.
I think it's a good reminder for people at home who have homes, who have food, who have internet access, that as hard as this is for them, there are people who don't have those basic, you know, go back to that pyramid that Dan was talking about at the beginning of the show. And there are people who are anxious and worried all over. At a time when anxiety is high, counting your blessings is also a really good thing, and things that we can be grateful for what we do have, and how we might help those who don't at a time where we really can't face to face in person be helping them. What are things we all might be able to do?
So I think it's, I would like us to talk about recovery in the sense of transformation, that as we come out of this, we can really change some things. I want to hold off on that for a second so people get a more of a concrete understanding of how different places are. So you're a non-native English speaker, and now let's say you're fortunate enough to be able to go online for your classes. So what has always been quite difficult now, is it going to become impossible?
Well, I think it's an interesting question. I mean, there's ways in which, though, certain digital technologies actually make what are often understood as language barriers into non-issues for certain people. So that when everyone, for example, if you have access to a translate, if everyone is working through a digital sort of intermediary to navigate an educational experience, then having to put something into Google Translate is more readily accessible to you in a way that in a classroom that might disrupt your learning experience or be perceived as disruptive. But now everyone is working with something that positions them as having a barrier which for, again, many students, a barrier is what is always imposed on their learning experience. They don't know how to not learn without a barrier.
This is Schools In with Denise Pope and Dan Schwartz, and we're talking with Jonathan Rosa, thinking about the different barriers that exist right now during the coronavirus time, especially around people who have different needs, different resources, and how they're coping.
So is your proposition that those of us who've been more fortunate now finally understand what it is for those who've been less fortunate? Or, I mean, we only understand by analogy, of course, but...
I think potentially that's the, and we could get into this a little bit, but that's the hopeful part, that perhaps this would give people an insight into what it's like to have to work through all of these channels in order to access something that you imagine as being readily accessible. That's the hope, you know, now in terms of how this might be operationalized or how it might be taken up. It's not clear that that's how people will respond to it, but I would want to hope for that.
No, I mean, this is a very powerful thing for people who have physical disabilities, is to make other people be in a wheelchair. So they suddenly realize that curve is horrendous, right?
That's it. And that the world has been systematically constructed to facilitate certain people's movement through it, and that we could remake the world so that it's more accessible for people, and that that's not just a naturally occurring thing. It's what we make of it.
I think, Jonathan, I'm also worried about a line that I heard, which is the groups that depend on schools most now have the least amount of access to resources. And I'm hoping that people follow what you said and kind of think differently and think about what it might mean to be in a crisis situation all the time. But I am worried that so many different schools are doing this differently, that it's just going to really exacerbate some of the problems that existed before. And I'm just going to give a couple examples. Across the country, there's not a consistency in how schools are dealing with this. So there are some schools that are sending home packets and textbooks. There are some schools that are asking kids to be online from 8 to 3, and knowing that there are some kids in their district who maybe don't have that capability. There are schools that are sending devices home, but they don't realize that families don't have internet access. There are some schools that are asking parents to take a lead in teaching when that parent may not have that capability, either because they don't speak the language or don't have the ability, but also because they might be people who are going into work every day because they're first responders. Or, you know, so I think there's a bunch of differences going on in terms of how education is being delivered. And I think there's a bunch of people who are very worried about what this is going to look like in the fall when we all hopefully come back together.
I think this is so important, the question of the ad hoc kind of responses that emerge here and how idiosyncratic they are based on the particular context, the particular community, teachers, administrators, students involved, and the ways that some people might be inclined to respond in ways that sort of recognize the particular needs that and don't take for granted that everyone has access to internet, to technology, to space, and to relationships that would help to facilitate certain kinds of learning experiences. I think the idiosyncratic nature of things is a concern, though, and part of what it suggests to me is that this can't be a situation where we respond to things on the fly. And it raises the question of what happens when we design schools in the first place with these experiences at the front and center, rather than always positioning them on the periphery. And so that's what I would want to think with. How does this become an opportunity for us to kind of rethink whose experiences we're attending to most centrally as we approach schools?
This is Schools In with Denise Pope and Dan Schwartz, and we're talking with Jonathan Rosa about the response to the coronavirus in schools and just how different these responses have been, even in communities that are right next door to one another.
So let me give a concrete example, and I could use both of your help thinking about this. So there are some school districts that have decided that, you know, the teachers are still teaching, they're teaching online, the kids are getting on, they're getting homework assigned. You know, this is a fairly typical approach, but there's some school districts where they've decided they're only going to do review of material because there are some students who cannot get online, and it would be unfair to them if the rest of the students got ahead while they got left behind. So part of that, I get it. You know, there's another part of me that says the way to make things fair is to hobble other people so that other people don't get left behind. Right. So the kids who should be getting more instruction, you know, let them have it. So I have trouble thinking this one through, right? I sort of see both sides. One is the fair thing to do is to make sure that nobody gets left behind. The fair thing to do is to make sure that the people who can continue to benefit from the best we can do should continue to benefit. So help me think this through.
I have to say that your invocation of hobbling invokes the Stephen King book and film Misery for me, where that was a particular torture technique. So I'm not sure, you know, that would be, you know, the frame. I hear what you're
sorry. The reason I say hobbling is since this began, just even before it started yet big, I kept thinking this is the zombie apocalypse, which is sort of my base metaphor. And so that's where the hobbling comes
from. It makes good sense. And I also understand the spirit of the question, though, which is, you know, how is it that we should respond to this in ways that don't privilege certain people or just, you know, propel certain people even further ahead? And so I guess for me, you know, one of the things that's really interesting is that for so many people, there's this recognition that the normative curriculum is just not possible in this moment. It's not possible to proceed in any straightforward way with what our plans were. And so I think, you know, the question that occurs to me then is, okay, so is the goal to adapt right now to see how much of that we could achieve based on these shifting conditions? Or perhaps is the question whether we should be rethinking what the mainstream curriculum was in the first place? And so my brother is a high school teacher in Rochester, New York, and he teaches at a place called School Without Walls, and it's a community-based, you know, it comes out of a history of community-based learning where the whole point was your lived experiences were supposed to be the centerpiece of the curriculum is supposed to emerge out of what we're facing in the world, what students are facing in their everyday lives. That's what the subject area is. That's how we define what learning goals are and needs are. And it seems like a situation like this is a perfect example of how that kind of an approach to education could help us to rethink what mathematics is, what science is, what literature is, what history is. And I think that it's a profound opportunity. So that's where I am with things.
I'm with you on the optimism. I'd like to think that this really puts a way for us to pause and reflect on what school ought to be as we try to rethink all those things, particularly as someone who looks at curriculum. I think it's always a little bit humorous when people say to me, well, not humorous isn't necessarily the right word, but they're so worried that their kids are not going to be where they need to be from missing X amount of weeks, as if they were absolutely remembering every single thing that they were taught at all times, right? So I think part of what we need to do is give people a little bit of calm. And I think we will do that right when we come back. This is Schools In with Denise Pope and Dan Schwartz, and we will have more with Jonathan Rosa and how schools are responding to the coronavirus next on SiriusXM.
This is Schools In.
I'm not an expert at this. Okay. I'm more expert than you.
When you can't read in American society, you are really left out.
With Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope from the campus of Stanford University.
Welcome back to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We are talking with Jonathan Rosa about schools and how they're responding to the coronavirus. And we had mentioned a real inconsistency. Different schools are doing different things. Some are sending packets home. Some are closing for good. Some are doing everything in between, online school as normal, trying to make it as normal as possible. And I brought up that people were quite worried about the loss of learning that might occur as this goes on and on for weeks on end.
There are a lot of things that will change after people begin to really experience the complexity of it. I think there's going to be some pain that teachers, parents, kids will experience. You know, maybe not sharp pain for everyone, but boy, it's a disruption. It's difficult. When I think about the learning outcomes, I know a lot of parents are concerned about my kids falling behind, something like that. I have to admit, I'm not as deeply concerned about that, assuming this lasts a couple of months. What I'm more concerned about is if the children experience some sort of trauma, right? Whether it's at home, there's some explosion of emotions, or parents are communicating fear. Trauma is the sort of thing that can happen once and stick. So my advice to the world, based just on my wisdom, is really work hard to help your children make sense of this and help them adapt as you adapt as well.
I agree, Jonathan. I'm sure you have something to say as well. First, top priority has to be health and well-being, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and I think this is a message for teachers out there as well, who are immediately faced with this question of a planned curriculum or with learning goals and a vision for what they were hoping that their students might experience this year, and perhaps are now faced with some questions about how to make sure that their students are felt recognized and heard and, you know, are able to experience some form of stability and potentially even safety and healing in the context of a profoundly traumatic moment. I think what for many people will be a profoundly traumatic moment. And so perhaps as our, you know, educators are thinking about what their goals might be, you know, I think having a connection with their students' experiences. And of course, this comes with tremendous responsibilities. Once you make someone's experience the centerpiece of your interaction with them, you know, you have to make sure that you're equipped with the tools to respond to those experiences. And so I think working in these kinds of areas and with these kinds of commitments in mind, the safety and responding to the experiences, the traumatic experiences that students are having, this is, you know, what's it look like to reshape one's curriculum or one's learning goals with these kinds of issues in mind.
And I'll just give some ideas that I thought were fabulous. So obviously, if kids have internet, you can check in with kids each day, right? And seeing their teacher's face and having a good morning message and talking to them. And then for kids who don't have internet, most kids have a phone, or there's a family phone, or there's a family cell phone. And so you can check in that way as well. It doesn't only have to be internet. I also know that PBS is doing free TV, because if you don't have internet access, you often have TV access. And there are some schools thinking about setting up some local TV spots that PBS would air. So there, I think ways to check in each day with a student is something that every teacher can think about and build into their curriculum right now.
So I would like to pick up where I think Jonathan has been leaning the whole time, which is towards the recovery and recreation of education. So at Stanford, it's been, I kind of have a front row seat on decision-making, and it's quite interesting. But one of the important things they did is they created a command and control structure that they learned from Katrina, and it gives new functions and everything. So there's the health team, there's the education team, and so forth. Now they're making the team that's called the Recovery Committee. So as we, you know, gyrate to handle the short and midterm, the long term, as we come out of this, what do we want it to be, right? How can we change the way we do things so that we're better in the future? I got my list, but I'll let you go first, Jonathan. What are some of the things that you think coming out of this, we can do a lot better?
Well, I think one of the interesting things about technology being front and center in this discussion, or the assumption that we would immediately be able to just transition into doing everything online, is that, of course, digital tools can be wonderful platforms for facilitating learning experiences. But let's learn with the populations, with especially special needs populations and scholars who have been working on these issues for so long, trying to, and again, locate those experiences at the front and center of what we're up to. So that's one piece with technology. This shouldn't be now we can adapt to this, now we can do this easily. No, this is something people have been grappling with for a long time. And we've said to those populations for so long that we couldn't do this. And now all of a sudden we can, because we have to. And so I think the new mandate has to be for everyone. So that's one piece. Another issue that's really important to me here is to, again, say, what if community-based learning, what if learning that roots the challenges that communities are facing at the center of one's educational experience, what if that's how we do schooling, so that the kinds of issues that everyone is grappling with right now, how to ensure access to food, access to safety, access to housing, access to all of these forms of stability, that shouldn't be something that we discover is a problem in crisis. That's a problem, or that's a challenge that we're always facing. And what's it look like to build schools around that and a curriculum around that? And again, to me, this isn't about watering down what our curricular areas look like. This is about saying, what kind of a world are we trying to create through these learning experiences? And how is it that the design of our curriculum and the relationships that we build within schools are a prefigurative realization of that world? that we want to live in. And right now, I think it's a moment, again, of reckoning where we say, perhaps this world that we've been creating is not a particularly stable place. And, you know, that should challenge us to kind of rethink what we're up to.
This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope, and we're talking with Jonathan Rosa about coronavirus responses in schools. And I think teachers and schools are going to get a whole lot more respect because parents at home are going to realize just how hard it is to do the job that they do on a daily basis, and there'll be an appreciation there, along with the changes that Jonathan's saying hopefully comes to pass as well, that we need to do a better job of really making schools more equitable. I have another wish that we will really rethink how we deliver learning in a way that isn't about lectures and taking tests. I mean, one of the biggest questions I'm getting from people is, how do you give a secure test online? And that is so not the right question to be asking right now, right? First of all, we know there are many, many different ways to assess kids, and tests are really outdated for the most part, and don't need to be the main mode of assessment that they tend to be across this country.
So let's see. So I agree with Jonathan and you on new delivery mechanisms and new affordances that allow you to consider the inequities and address them more directly. You know, a striking thing is we had a meeting of the faculty to discuss an important matter, and there were about 50 people in the faculty. And because when everybody talked, their picture showed up big, people thought it was an intimate conversation, and their questions were way too long. And so I thought it was sort of a view of how it's going to change my interactions as a teacher, as a learner with other people. So I think that's one. Exams, boy, this is everybody's going to have to figure out how to adapt to this or get eye tracking software to make sure the kids aren't cheating.
No eye tracking software.
I think there will be an increased premium on creating independent learners, right, so that they can learn on their own. And perhaps Jonathan's community-based schools is a strong motivation and a source of knowledge for a kid to be a more independent learner. Finally, just because I'm a school of education at a research university, I think we're going to be able to learn a lot about how to make things better through research.
Agreed. Thank you. Thank you so much, Jonathan, for being on. And thank all of you for listening to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. If you missed any of this episode, listen anytime on demand with the SiriusXM app, on iTunes and SoundCloud.
From the campus of Stanford University, this has been Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope on SiriusXM Business Radio. If you missed any of it, listen on demand, online, or with the SiriusXM app.